Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so the next speaker at the Tutor Summit is Melita Thomas, and as you can see, we're actually together in person, which so really, yeah. And we are at we're together because we're actually doing our podcast live at this Tutor and 17th Century Experience home, which is amazing to be
absolutely
at.
Absolutely magical.
So yeah. We've come a little early to record this talk, but if you've been in the group, you probably will have seen the notices about this going on in the Facebook Lives and stuff like that. So that's where Melita and I are right now. So Melita's going to talk about ladies in waiting at the Tudor court.
Yes.
Which is a really exciting topic, yeah, and I'm really excited to learn about.
It was a very interesting one to research, in fact.
What made you decide on it?
Well, I was thinking about it in, you remember Downton Abbey, of course, and we all remember Downton Abbey, and probably a lot of people who watched Downton Abbey saw the relationship between Lady Mary and Anna, mm-hmm. the long-suffering Anna, I have to say, and Lady Mary's really quiet. And they might have wondered, well, you know, that's the lady's maid, but what was it like in the Tudor period? Because you hear about the queens having their ladies-in-waiting and their maids of honour, and, you know, was it a similar sort of relationship or was it very different? Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it was actually very different in the Tudor period because Tudor queens were actually much closer to their domestic servant. They weren't servants in the same way that by the Victorian period the lady's maid was a servant.
Because they were other nobility and things like that.
And the whole concept of service in the 15th, 16th and 17th centuries was very different from how it was in the 19th and 20th centuries, because everybody, other than the king and royalty basically, everybody waited on somebody else. Mm. It was a very hierarchical society, but there was a concept of, you know, the servant and the master having a relationship that conferred obligation in both in both ways. And the theory was that if you didn't know how to serve, you couldn't command. So even royalty, in fact, I mean Queen Margaret of Denmark, she was Queen of Scots to James III, she insisted that her son, who was later King James IV, was trained as a page, so he could wait on her, so he knew what it was like to serve. And that was the whole concept. So for both men and women, that you went into the household of somebody of a similar rank or higher than yourself, and you learned to be a servant in their house. But the word servant didn't mean what it meant in the time of Downton Abbey.
And you also might go into their house to get, like, marriage prospects and things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So, typically, a girl, when she was about 12 or 14, she'd go into this household, often of the man she was going to marry or one of the brothers, and she would wait on the mistress of the house. And then she would learn the trade of being a mistress of a great house. And when she married the son and became the mistress, she would take on another generation of young women. And so there wasn't that gulf that there was in the later period. And at the very top of society, the nobleman's daughters waited on the queen. And they would then have their own ladies, who would then have a waiting woman, who would write down to the people right at the bottom.
It's like a pyramid scheme.
Exactly. yes, that's it, exactly. And people moved in the upper echelons. They would move amongst the sort of levels as they got older. So in Elizabeth of York's household, for example, her two sisters, Cicely of York and Anne of York, they both had official positions as ladies of her bedchamber. Cicely was chief, and then when she got married, it was Anne. And 50 years later, at Catherine Parr's household, her sister Anne Herbert was her lady-in-waiting, and her cousin Maud Lane was another one of them. So there were, of course, people below, there were the women called the chamberers who, you know, changed the bedding and did the laundering, emptied the slops. But even they could be close to their mistress. Catherine of Aragon left, I mean, obviously she wasn't in the position she was as a queen, but when she died, she mentioned Mistress Margery, who'd been one of her chamberers, mm-hmm. in her will. Mm-hmm. So you could have a warmer relationship even with somebody who actually seemed quite low down the pecking order. So within the royal household, you had the ladies-in-waiting, and then you had the maids of honour. And the ladies-in-waiting were the older women, usually married, probably closer in age to the queen, and her friends.
And they would also have their own households then?
Yes.
How did that work?
If you were a lady-in-waiting and you were married, which most of them were, you worked on a rota. Okay. So you'd be on for 3 months, or I don't know, and there's no evidence as to the exact timescales, but it's apparent that they had a tour of duty, effectively.
Okay.
And then they would go home, and then they'd have children, and then they'd come back.
I see.
And Eleanor Paston, who was Countess of Rutland, she managed to have 11 children in the period 1523 to 1539, and she served Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, and Catherine Howard.
Oh, my.
So she was a busy girl. And then, you know, when they were doing their stint at home, they'd have they'd be bearing children, they'd be looking after the estate when their husband was away, and then they would come back on rota. And later, Elizabeth I was very mean about her rotas, so her poor cousin Catherine Carey was almost never allowed any time off. Mm. Every time she went off to have one of her numerous children, Elizabeth demanded that she come back immediately. Elizabeth wasn't the best employer, I don't think.
She was a very nice boss, was she?
No, she was very, very exacting, perhaps more so than the other queens. So the ladies-in-waiting would tend to be friends. So Catherine of Aragon's close friend was Maria de Salinas, mm-hmm. who'd come with her from Spain and married Lord Willoughby de Earsby. And Maria's daughter, Catherine Willoughby, Duchess, and became a friend of Catherine Parr's, mm-hmm. although not to the extent that she wanted to look after Catherine's daughter when she died. So, yeah, there's friends and friends, really, aren't there?
Right.
Yeah. And the Scottish court, there's the famous the Five Marys.
Right.
So Mary Stuart had her four Marys, and they were friends. They mm-hmm. were genuinely close. And Mary Seton, one of them, despite being a nobleman's daughter, she learned hairdressing, and she was a famous hairdresser for the Queen.
How
so she looked
funny.
After...
Yeah.
Mary, Queen of Scots, apparently had exceptionally beautiful hair.
Huh.
So it wasn't looked down upon. So the thing that Anna's doing in Downton Abbey, which is sort of very menial, was not considered that for a queen.
And surely it would have been a great privilege to be able to work on the Queen's
exactly.
hair. Such level of intimacy.
Yes, and chat and you know. And,
it's like
and
the groom of the stool for a...
Yeah, I suppose it is, actually. Yes, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if the Queen's had groom or ladies of the stool. They must have done, but I haven't come across any. Yes.
Hmm. There's another history's mystery.
Yeah. Yes, have you seen at Sudley Castle, Catherine Parr's little loo?
Mm.
No, it's a little red velvet box. And you think, velvet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But perhaps, anyway, let's just not go into that one.
Yeah. Moving right along.
So the maids of honour were younger. They were, to be in the royal household, they were 16.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we know that because in 1536, Lady Lyle was trying to find a position for her daughter Anne Bassett in Queen Jane's household, and she was told, no, she's too young, she's only 15, you know, try again. So the maids of honour, they were younger, they were not married, and they had a supervisor called the Mother of the Maids, whose job was to keep these young women in check. And at Henry's court, it was a lady named Mrs. Stoner for the later queens.
Okay.
Quite how she got that position, I don't know, but there she's mentioned.
And they all would sleep in dorms and stuff together, or would they have their own room?
Well, nobody had their own room. Right. Even the king or queen shared a room.
Sure.
So even the queens regnant, Mary and Elizabeth, had, until Mary was married, they had a bedfellow.
Okay.
Nobody slept alone. So they would have slept... probably the maids of honour, probably half a dozen in the room together. Yeah. The ladies in waiting may have had a bit more privacy, but conceptually privacy just...
Yeah. Would they have shared a bed?
Too? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Certainly, yes. Yeah. Say, even the Queen shared a bed.
Yeah.
So, so you'd probably get two of the ladies in waiting tucked up together.
Yeah.
Or if the lady in waiting, if she was one of the great ladies, who were the ladies who weren't employed exactly, but they attended on the Queen if they were at court, you know, and their husband may have had rooms and they'd have possibly shared with their
okay.
or stayed in the in the Queen's, so that the household was divided into the King's side and the Queen's side.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't necessarily that much interaction between the men and the women, other than in the official rooms.
Yeah.
So eating in the Great Hall,
yeah,
they'd have done together.
That's interesting. That's like even the White House has the West Wing and the East Wing, where okay, one is the purview of the First Lady and the other one okay is where the president does his
right
business.
I didn't know that. So yeah, yes, exactly the same concept, the ladies and the gentlemen. So the maids had to bring their own linen, and they had a single waiting woman each. And okay, under Queen Jane, they got paid £10 a year. And I'm guessing it would have been more or less the same throughout the century. So.
And were they told what kind of clothing to wear? Oh, you're going to even talk about that.
Yeah, well, so we know most about how they were employed because of Lady Lyle's efforts to get her daughter Anne Bassett employed by Queen Jane. And she sends endless letters to all the ladies she knows. She knows Lady Rutland. Her niece is Mary Arundel, who was a maid of honour and about to become a lady-in-waiting when she married the Earl of Sussex.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, letters to saying, what should I send the Queen? How can I suck up to the Queen and get my daughter a job?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually Jane said, OK, send me your two girls, Catherine and Anne, and one of them can have a place and I'll decide which I like based on her, I think it was her fashions and her condition, her manners, her fashions and her conditions.
How funny.
Yeah, and Jane was of a similar sort of background. She would have known that you know, money wasn't too flush.
Mm-hmm.
So she said to Lady Lyle, send your daughters, but they, until I choose one, they only need to bring two suits of clothing, one in silk and one in damask.
Okay.
And obviously that means, you know, the dress and obviously all their underthings and all the rest of it. Okay. Yeah. Once they were employed and Jane took Anne Bassett, they would have had, the maids of honour had livery, which wouldn't have been uniform like the lower servants wore, but it would have been a badge with the Queen's arms or the royal initials, probably on a gown of black or some dark, because dark fabrics were more expensive.
So okay, that, yes.
You know. There's from the early 1520s, when Mary was Princess of Wales, her lower servants were all dressed in her colours of blue and green, and that was a livery, and the ladies and the gentlewomen wore black velvet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
okay.
You know, they didn't have to wear sort of the fancy stripes that they were in the trunk hose. So the maid of honour, she would swear allegiance to her mistress, and her conduct would be regulated by the household ordinances,
okay,
which told them how they had to behave, and there was to be no quarrelling and fighting.
Okay.
So what do they all do? In less exalted households, and as I say, this went on all the way down the social scale, the women have very real duties to perform. And although, you know, no lady of gentle birth would milk a cow,
mm-hmm,
the lady of the manor, she would look after her dairy, she would supervise what was going on in the kitchens. She wouldn't cook day-to-day meals,
okay,
but she would get involved in culinary specialities.
Okay.
So where the ingredients were valuable, such as sugar, the lady of the house would often make the confectionery herself, and her women helped her.
Okay.
Lady Lyle made quince marmalade, which she sent to Henry VIII, much to his delight. He was very partial to a bit of marmalade. The Mary Queen of Scots and her Marys learnt to make marmalade and to crystallise fruit.
Mm.
Isabella of Castile brought up her daughters to sew and to understand housewifely duties, even though they were the best educated women in Europe at the time. The lady might also make her own medicines, put potions in her still room. Then they managed the servants. They looked after the children.
So all of the kind of traditional women taking care of the home,
yes,
kind of things.
Yes, but the mistress would also look after legal business and estate, okay, business if her husband was away. I mean,
right.
I mean, you know, there was no equality in society in the way we think of it. But women had a position and they had power within their sphere. Mm-hmm. Women ran the household, and you know that was their job.
Yeah.
One of the major tasks was sewing, all levels of society.
Right.
So even, I mean, you see the beautiful embroideries, and we've looked at some today, and that was what the ladies of the court did. They did fine embroidery, but Queen Catherine of Aragon sewed her husband's shirts, and she was very famous for doing that. And Henry got himself into trouble with Anne Boleyn when he still went to his wife to have his shirts sewn, and Lady Anne was not very happy about that.
Yeah,
they had a bit of a quarrel about that one. So, you know, that, and then if they weren't all sewing, they would be making music, they would be dancing, they played chess. they read aloud. They didn't. Private reading was not something that came in until the end of the 16th century. Okay. Reading was nearly all allowed. They took part in the exercise. They hunted. They hawked. Ladies did that as well as gentlemen. They did archery. Mary Queen of Scots and her attendants played tennis, although that seems to have been fairly unusual for women to do that. But archery, bowls, marbles. There's vision of them playing marbles. They went to the court ceremonies. They greeted the ambassadors. They played in the masks. The first mention of Anne Boleyn in history is in the English court is at the mask in 1523, where she played one of the ladies in the Tower.
Perseverance.
Apparently so. Although everybody says that, but it doesn't. I've never actually found to prove that she, Perseverance was one of the ladies, okay. But everybody says it was her, and of course it would certainly fit. Yes. And they would watch the king jousting, and there's a picture of Catherine and her ladies watching Henry doing his manly bit.
Yes.
And because the role of the lady in waiting was sort of a public face, it was sometimes stipulated that they had to be good looking.
Okay.
So when Catherine of Aragon was being prepared to come to England, Henry VII wrote to her parents and said, make sure that she only brings beautiful ladies with her.
Fair enough.
And the ladies who were chosen for the masks, it was on their looks. It wasn't on their, I'm afraid, me too, I'm afraid, didn't have anything to do with their dramatic ability. It was purely on their looks. So if a princess married abroad, she would take her entourage with her. Mm-hmm. And usually she'd have an older woman to look after her. Mary of England had Lady Gifford to look after her when she went to France. Catherine of Aragon had a bit of a dragon by the sound of it, Doña Elvira. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the ladies were well-treated, and sometimes they weren't. Catherine of Aragon's ladies were well-treated, and two of them went on to marry English noblemen, Maria de Salinas and Inés de Vinega. Some were not so lucky. Mary of England, when she married Louis XII of France, he insisted on sending all of her ladies home. Mm-hmm. And Mary's absolutely distraught, and she wrote to Henry, "I am left most alone, for on the morn after my marriage were discharged, and then likewise my mother Gifford, with other my women and maidens, except such as never had any experience nor knowledge how to advise me or give me counsel in any time of need." Mm. And there she was, 18 years old, in a foreign court.
That's horrible.
But they were luckier than some.
Okay.
20 years earlier, when Juana of Castile, Catherine of Aragon's sister,
Juana.
Married Philip of Burgundy.
He was terrible.
He was horrible. He would not... The custom was that the queen or the wife had her own money and she paid her servants. Mm-hmm. He would not give her her jointure, which she was supposed to do.
Right.
So she couldn't pay her servants, and he would not pay her servants. Mm-hmm. So eventually they all left her, were replaced by his people, and she had no one to turn to. And he was... sure, she was mad. Funny that. Yeah, he was
be mad not a nice too. Man. He was not terrible. A nice man.
So you can imagine that. She's stuck in this household with no friends from home who is just horrible.
Very sad.
Yeah, so, I mean, they had a regulation number of attendants, and competition was fierce. So Lady Dial had to spend an awful lot of presents to Queen Jane to get one of her daughters into the household. But she scored because... her husband was governor of Calais, and Calais was where they hunted quail.
Oh, right. So when she was pregnant, didn't she send some quail?
She sent lots and lots of quail, yes, as well as suitable other presents to Lady Rutland and, people who had the Queen's ear, and eventually it paid off.
So it's who you know.
Absolutely. Mm. It never changes, yes. Jane Seymour was quite keen to have a more sedate court than Anne Boleyn had had.
Right.
So although... it seems very, very unlikely that Anne was in any way guilty of adultery. Her quite familiar manners with her gentlemen, it made it plausible, even if so, nobody would have said that Catherine of Aragon was having an affair. I mean, right. It would just have been ridiculous.
Yeah.
But Anne Boleyn was more flirtatious. Mm-hmm. So Jane Seymour was obviously keen to have a very, very sedate court. And Anne Bassett, when she got the job, was told to be sober, sad, wise and discreet.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Alison Weir talked about that a little bit in the historical fiction about Jane, that she almost kind of separated herself too and was very determined that she wasn't going to have
exactly. She was going to be much more regal and, more like Catherine of Aragon had been or Elizabeth of York and preserve that distance between the Queen and her lesser beings.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, once there were queens regnant, Mary and Elizabeth, the role of the ladies-in-waiting changed a bit because...
They almost become then the advisors.
Exactly. They had a much more likelihood of political influence than previous ladies-in-waiting had had. There was a lady who was obviously Mary's closest friend. She was the mistress of the robes. She was Susan Tong, her name was, but she's known as Susan Clarencieux. I never know how to pronounce it because her husband was Clarencieux Herald.
Oh, okay.
And she was considered to be quite a conduit to the Queen. So a generous present to Susan got you to all sorts of places.
Yeah.
That they had, so the two queens, they had the three ladies of the bedchamber. They had seven ladies and gentlemen of the privy chamber. And the famous one that Elizabeth had was Blanche Parry.
Okay.
Who had been with her since she was a small child. Then there were the four chambers who said the more menial tasks and the maids of honour. And there were still the great ladies who, Margaret Douglas, the Queen's cousin, she was one of the great ladies because she was too good to serve the Queen. But she was a fixture at Mary's court because they were friends. Mm-hmm. But when Elizabeth came to the throne, she decided that Margaret was no longer welcome and Margaret was sent off to her estates in the north. And the other one who was demoted was Catherine Grey.
Mm.
In Mary's reign, she was one of the ladies of the Privy Chamber. So just showing how the sort of complexity of the relationships, because, of course, Jane Grey, Catherine's sister, had tried to oust Mary from the throne, but Mary, having forgiven her cousin, Jane's mother...
Elizabeth didn't treat those Grey sisters very nice, did she?
No, she didn't. No, Mary was kinder to them than Elizabeth was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so Catherine was demoted from the Privy Chamber, which was close to the Queen, to the least that she could actually decently give her as her cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth was an exacting mistress. So as I say, poor Catherine Carey, no matter how many children she had to keep coming back. She wasn't allowed to have her time off.
Mm.
And later, Elizabeth became... bad tempered, we say, with her. So it was not unknown for her to throw things at them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story that she actually broke one maid's finger by throwing a hairbrush at her. Oops. Now, poor Elizabeth, she wasn't perhaps a nice woman to work for, but you think of the stress of the position.
Sure.
It wouldn't, and she didn't like her maids getting married. She got very, very upset about that. So, and Elizabeth, she didn't like eating in public. So one of the things that her ladies had to do was wait on her at table.
Mm.
So the food would be sent in to her and they would carve
the
meat.
Why didn't she like eating in public? Was it because of her teeth? And...
I don't know, really. Wouldn't you like, because you see pictures and the king... It was a very important part of medieval kingship to eat in the Great Hall.
Right.
And they would sit up there, but every mouthful was being watched. Imagine just sitting there and everybody watching you eat your dinner. Elizabeth didn't eat a lot. She was actually quite abstemious, and she didn't eat a lot, and she didn't like these sort of long banquets, everybody sitting and eating and drinking. Yeah. Just didn't do it for her. She watered all her wine. She was very, apart from sugar, which she ate so much of. So she liked to keep her food private, and she would have a woman to share her bedroom with. It's not absolutely clear whether she shared the Queen's bed. I mean, they're known as bedfellows, and of course the beds were quite big, but she would certainly have slept in the same room because even a monarch never slept. No one was ever alone. It must have been horrible, actually.
Yeah.
So the ladies, they washed her, they dressed her, they combed her hair, they decked her with her makeup and created her image of Gloriana. Mm-hmm. Without the ladies-in-waiting, there would be no Gloriana.
Interesting. And how did their... Well, I suppose I was going to say, how do you think it changed from the 1480s to the end of Elizabeth's reign? And even, do you know much about Anne of Denmark and how her...
Anne of Denmark, sorry.
We're having some lovely, what is this?
Lamb's wool.
Lamb's wool that Brigitte made us.
And couldn't resist it. Apparently, it's made to the authentic recipe, she tells us. It's apple, it's got little bits of apple floating. Mm-hmm. It's sort of clear with spices and it tastes just like a good apple pie.
And it's we have these authentic mugs because what these mugs do is keep the apple bits from going in our mouth as we drink. So that's why it has these little curves.
Anyway. So sorry, I couldn't resist a mouthful.
Well, I've been sipping here as you've been talking. Anne of Denmark.
Yeah, so Anne of Denmark, again, when she was Queen of Scots, She became Queen of Scots. She was only 15. Mm-hmm. And again, we think about all these people, and they're just young girls, and they're in a foreign country. And she became very close to some of her Scottish ladies. And that created a bit of friction in her marriage, because she was sometimes more supportive of her ladies than her husband was entirely comfortable with, because there were all these factions in the Scottish court.
Right.
And Lady Huntley, who was her favourite lady, was rumoured to be a Catholic, and did convert, which didn't go down too well.
No.
Although it was kept secret, it was never openly admitted, it was widely rumoured. And when James inherited, Robert Cecil was sort of in charge of absolutely everything, and he sort of decided which the chief ladies who had been Elizabeth's chief ladies would become Anne's. And so he sent a delegation of them to meet the Queen at the border.
Mm.
But a couple of ladies who hadn't been chosen by Cecil got ahead and got to Edinburgh.
Oh.
So there was Lucy, Lady Bedford, and Penelope Rich, and they more or less became Anne's favourite ladies until Penelope Rich fell out of favour for her remarriage. But Lucy, the Countess of Bedford, became a very close friend of the Queen's, and of course they were young women. She didn't want to be, you know, Anne was in her 20s. She didn't want these 16, 17-year-old women hanging about.
Sure.
But in her reign, or her time as Queen, The masks became an even more important part of court life, and they were extravagant in the extreme. Mm. I mean, people complained about the price, but in fact, it did bring the English court much more back into line with Europe after the isolation of Elizabeth's reign.
Yeah.
Anne had her Danish and her German relatives, and the King of Denmark visited. So it did raise the prestige of the English court, and she had Ben Jonson and Inigo Jones, who did the designs. And the ladies, there's some beautiful pictures in the V&A, the drawings. So her ladies were also very, very much a part of the ceremonial of the court.
Oh, how neat. And so it sounds like, so there was this, during Mary and Elizabeth, the women had much more, the ladies in waiting had more of a role in government.
Yes.
And then it went back to masks and...
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and obviously the king's personal friends then had a lot of influence.
When do you think it started turning into this Downton Abbey servant kind of thing?
It's not a period I've studied, but probably in the late 17th, in the 18th century was probably the big change.
Okay.
It became the roles, so you started getting the housekeeper, who was no longer, so the lady who might have been the, you know, sort of lower ranking woman, say a baron's wife or something, she might have had one waiting woman, who then sort of turned into the housekeeper, and then there was more stratification. So, 18th century. Mm-hmm. And even one of the innovations that came in with the late 18th, early 19th century was the bells.
Oh, okay.
And before bells, they were just people. So you'd have somebody sitting outside the room or sitting in the room with you.
Yeah. So you were close to them.
So you were much closer to them. But once you had the bell, they were off in the servants' hall.
Right.
And that created a big division.
Space.
As in the 15th century, because... you know, before this period, they were even closer in that they all slept together in the Great Hall.
Yeah.
So you couldn't help but be more intimately acquainted with people. But as the notion of privacy, which was became a sort of Georgian idea.
Yeah, I see.
That's when they changed you no longer, and possibly when the public schools for the boys, so they no longer went and you weren't a budding knight.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have to go into service. Samuel Pepys was a servant in his cousin's house, and he rose to become, you know, First Lord of the Admiralty or whatever he was.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much for telling us so much about Ladies in Waiting. Tell me about where people can find you and your stuff. I need to take some pictures. We've got some of your lovely products over there, and you've got your book, and so do you want to tell me about some of that?
So in a minute we're going to be talking about my book, The King's Pearl, which I talked about in the last Tudor Summit. We have hopefully a few more questions, and we have the Tudor Times website, and there is an article on there about Ladies in Waiting with a bibliography of sources where you can find out some more of the details. So we've got our Tudor Times shop, which has some nice products, some tote bags, which we're very pleased with, and some posters that, I mean, our absolute favourite is I Am No Morning Woman by, as Elizabeth first said, because actually one of the things that Elizabeth and Mary's women did was walk with them. Both both the queens were great walkers, but Elizabeth liked to have a, she was a late night person. Okay. Mary was an early morning person.
Cool. So that's shop.tudortimes.
shop.tudortimes.co.uk. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Well, wonderful. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's I think that's good.
We're done. Awesome. Perfect. Thank you so much for watching, and we'll see you in the next talk. Bye.